I'm going to read you something that I'm in the middle of writing. It's about a fella called David Marcus. David Marcus was the literary editor of the Irish Press many, many years ago. And he's 25 years dead. So they're having a book, a memorial book coming out with writings from different people that he helped as a literary editor, and I was one of them. He was the first person to publish poems by me when I was only a teenager. And it's amazing how the confidence of an adult can affect a young person. And I'll just read it for you first. I've spent the past 3 or 4 days now writing this, and I'll be sending it away this morning, and I'll just read it for you, and then I'll chat about it. So here is the piece. I was 15 when I first posted a poem to David Marcus at the Irish Press. I was 15 when I received a letter of reply. It sat on the dining room table all day while I was at school. I came home on the bus, worrying about leaving certificate honours maths classes, which I had recently begun. I had completed the intercert and was being forced to do honours maths against my will. I loved history and English, but maths frightened me. I feared the following 2 years might likely shatter my self-confidence and destroy any sense of worth I was developing. Instead of allowing me to do subjects I loved and to write poetry, I was informed that my future was in numbers, which I hadn't any possibility of comprehending. In those days, I studied in an empty dining room at a sombre mahogany table on which the letter had been left by my father, unopened. The table was bought in a swanky store in Dublin where my father had once worked as a child, packing boxes. While at national school, he was obliged to sell newspapers on the streets every afternoon to help support his impoverished family. He missed the end of each school day, and it so happened that the final lesson in those days was algebra. So, like other poor children, he never got beyond adding and subtracting. Being cheated out of what he loved, the magic of numbers, he resolved to make them a part of his adult life. So when he lost his job packing boxes at Pym Brothers on Georgia Street in the early 20s due to the onset of an economic depression, he decided to change his life and begin night classes. And there began the long ordeal of menial jobs by day and correspondence courses by night, from Rathmines to the University of Glasgow, until he eventually reached the dizzy heights of a profession and became county accountant for Cavan. Married in his 50s, he went back to an old friend who had packed boxes with him as a child and bought a sideboard, 4 chairs and a dining room table at which I did my homework. I loved that table. I saw it as a kind of symbol of my father's journey and struggle. And so, when my parents were long dead and the old house was being sold, I made sure to take the table with me to Leitrim, where I intended it to function as a temporary addition to our humble abode, until we got some furniture of our own. But at last did the length of my own child's childhood, and I would come home sometimes and smile to find her sitting there in the evenings attending to whatever absorbed her on the screen of her laptop. The letter that lay unopened in my youth was addressed to me in bold type, which indicated that it must be from an adult. And there was only one adult who might be writing to me in such an officious tone, using a white business class envelope and affixing the title Esquire to the end of my name. I didn't open it instantly. I needed to get my maths homework out of the way. If I opened the envelope and read the letter of rejection before I opened my maths books, I wouldn't have been able to finish any homework. So I slipped the letter between the pages of Patrick Kavanagh's collected works, which had been published about a year earlier, and which was, to me, a sacred text during those days. Eventually, before bedtime, I opened and read the letter, written and signed by David Marcus. It was like reading something from Moses, like listening to the verdict of a remote judge. The editor-in-chief of the most important poetry platform in the nation was addressing me. And he liked the poems, and he wanted to publish them. In those days, I used to get the bus to school, but I might as well have been a ghost. Neither the Loretta girls in their burgundy skirts nor the demure daughters of the Royal School ever bothered with me. I didn't play football, I didn't have long hair, and was never in trouble with the police, so I was a complete nonentity. Getting in trouble with various police forces would have been easy in those days, even if I were only 16. In Enniskillen, where we went regularly as a family to buy butter, there were always RUC men patrolling the street outside Wellworths and Woolworths, fingering their pistols as they glared at young boys like me. And I'm sure the slightest impudence would have brought their ire down upon me as I brushed past them in search of Milky Way bars that were not available in the Free State. Nonentities like me dreamed of such drama. How wonderful it would be if the story got out in Loretto that I was in trouble with the RUC. It never happened, although it wasn't the RUC that I feared. It was my mother who policed my adolescence as if I were a medieval prince. She marked out the social boundaries I dared not cross. And being rude with uniformed officers in Enniskillen was the gravest of boundaries, particularly since our car was stuffed with so much butter on the way home. And besides, I was so incompetent at everything that I couldn't even get arrested for not having a light on my bicycle. And I did try regularly, but without success. There was a guard in Cavan at the time who was zealous about the law regarding bicycle lamps. He would wait in the bushes or behind a low wall of suburbia, watching for college students cycling home after official study hours at night, hoping to catch someone who wasn't adequately illuminated. Even my mother thought he was an ignoramus, so it was a notoriety I could have aspired to without fearing her wrath if I had ended up in court. I regularly cycled out in front of the pack, alone and as visible as a black cat in a coal shed. But I was never fortunate enough to do it on a night when the guard was on duty. It would have been an heroic narrative had I been caught, and might have secured me more attention on the school bus. But at 16, I had resigned myself to a life of invisibility. Then the poems were published, and my life changed. The Beatles had recorded a few LPs, and Bob Dylan whined and wailed on transistor radio sets beneath the pillows of 1,000 young girls all over the country. And some of them sat by day on my school bus, and up until then, if ever I brushed past their shoulders, they remained as detached as Zen monks. But being a poet trumped even playing football. The heroic poet, solitary and melancholic, languishing in an attic, writing love poems. It would have been a matchless prize for any girl in burgundy or green. And sure enough, the moment I stepped onto the dance floor in Cavan after that first publication, I realised I had become a different person. At teenage dances or hops, as we used to call them, I slung my coat over my shoulders like it were a Yeatsian cloak, and for 18 more months I strode along the aisle of the school bus like a great colossus of wounded grace. I never mentioned this aspect of my good fortune to David Marcus when I met him for the first time some years later in his home in Dublin. Even then I was terrified of adults who had achieved so much in life. But I remember him being curious about my life as a writer, and so I mumbled to him something about a book I was working on and how I hoped it would be published. "Oh, it will," he said, with assurance. "It will." And then he added, "The first of many, I hope." For me, that was a moment as life-altering as the first letter, though it was just a casual remark. In that one supportive phrase, my self-image was reframed again. He was graciously presuming that I might be on a pathway as a writer for a long time. David Marcus influenced the shape of my life in both those moments, brief and terse and casual, but yet transformative for me. I felt his presence constantly as a mentor and a teacher to whom I remained deeply indebted. There were further letters from Mr. Marcus, and further poems by me in the Irish Press. There were short stories too, and some years later I received a Hennessy Award, which was another milestone on the way towards life as a full-time writer. It was David Marcus who advised me to use the title Michael P. Harding on my first book, since my father was already known as Michael Harding from his regular book reviews in the same paper. All the opportunities for writing and publishing were as direct or indirect consequences of that first letter and of David Marcus's confidence in my writing and the generosity with which he treated me as a young aspiring writer, as if he were sure that I had a future. And my father was quietly proud. Even though I may have written an occasional disparaging line about my childhood or my relationship with him, he never flinched in the face of poetry. Whenever he saw me at that old table in the dining room, opening other letters, or reading anything other than school books, he would say, "I won't interrupt you, you're at your work." My father died only 6 years after my first poems were published, and the table outlasted him by 50 years. Only last year, one leg collapsed and the tabletop was recycled as a workbench in the garden shed. So in fact, it even outlasted David Marcus by almost 25 years. There is a way in which I believe that our loved ones are forever with us and in us. So my father's ghost is still a real presence in my life. He shapes the determination to live well. And for an accountant in his later years, he got enormous pleasure from reading books and chiseling sentences and writing book reviews. Because David Marcus was the mentor who showed confidence in him too, in that long ago time of my childhood, when I dined on dreams. And that's the end of it. My reflections on David Marcus. I'm pleased with it enough as a piece of writing. I always try in a piece of writing to, you know, make it clear and make it simple. Make it as clear as possible so that you're not woolly. So you say something like about your father, you say something about the dining table. The dining table is the central image. And then you tie it together with, like, my father's journey as being somebody who achieved greatness because he became an accountant, and that was a huge achievement because of his drawbacks. And then me achieving something, you know, the connection with me and the father is the table, and then I'm at the table, and then I'm trying to achieve something. And then at the end, I just mention in passing that in actual fact, in later life, my father got the benefit of David Marcus as well. So that kind of brings the whole three of us together. And I think that the passion that drove me to write that is my passion for education. My belief that what you say to young people and what young people need you to say to them is summed up in that Irish Seanochle, the proverb, Mull an oige agus chuckishiet. Praise the youth and they will come, they will rise. They will come into their own, you know. And, like, to praise somebody is not flattery and it's not judgment. So flattery is where you'd be given praise where no praise is due. So let's say somebody writes a poem. Let's say a young person writes a poem, and so you praise it because it's a good poem. You don't praise it because it's a bad poem. And you don't say silly things to flatter somebody. But you praise them for what they've done well. And the problem is that when somebody, a young person, does something well, there's a tendency for adults to chastise them because even though they've done it well, they've kind of got the wrong answer, if you know what I mean. So an example would be, let's say, if when I was young I wrote a poem which had a really negative implication about my childhood, and maybe my father would sort of say, you shouldn't be writing poems that are criticising your childhood. So, because it might make him defensive. And that did happen with a particular poem that I wrote when I was 16, and it was published in the Irish Press. And it had a line in it that I'll write of death and decaying matter in some time, and that I had an unhappy childhood. And when my father read that poem and he came in, he never criticised me for writing that sentence. He praised the poem because he thought it was a good poem. And looking back on it, I think it's a great example of where I often hear teachers, and they're arguing with their students, or I hear parents arguing with their children, and they're kind of arguing against the ideas that the child has. You know, supposing a child believes in some of the modern ideas that maybe adults wouldn't believe in. I'll not bring anything in detail here. I don't want to be contentious by talking about particular political stuff, but you know what I mean, where a young person would come home and declare... I'll give you one example. A very, very conservative woman, a friend of mine, she's very, very conservative. And her daughter says to her one day, coming in from school, that she was a lesbian. She had decided she was a lesbian. And the mother says she lost the rag altogether and said, "You are not." I was like, "You're not going to be a lesbian in this house." The mother was outraged. The mother saw that this was, you know, she saw it as something wrong. I have to admit that. I think she saw it as wrong. But even if you thought something was wrong, you can acknowledge that the young person has made a genuine effort to work out for themselves who they are. So if a young person came to me and said, "I identify as a badger," I might think that's a kind of a fairly ludicrous thing to be saying to me, but if you're sincerely working that out, then I'm going to praise you for that. I'm not praising the idea that you're a badger, and here's the real subtle point I'm trying to make, that when you praise young people, they will flourish. So that even though they have the wrong answer now, you are helping them find the right answer. You don't have to tell them what the right answer is. You with me? Like some young child says, I want to be a rugby player and play in the World Cup for Ireland. And they're a girl. And they're 12 years of age and they're not going to a school that does rugby. So you say to them something like, "Well, I mean, you can't play rugby for Ireland because you're a girl." Or, "Well, I mean, they don't do rugby in your class, in your school, so you're hardly ever going to have a chance to be good enough for the Irish team, even if you were a boy." And that's a very caricatured example, but we do that as adults all the time to young people, where we almost ridicule their dreams. Because we can see from our experience that doesn't fit. You know, you're not going to be able to get to be a world champion rugby player if you're not training in rugby in the school you're in. And if you're seeing it as boys and girls and you haven't noticed you're a girl and, you know... And so we pour cold water on it. Instead of just praising the child for having made this kind of imaginative leap that they might be playing for Ireland as a rugby player. And when you encourage somebody like that, you're not really, you know that they're not going to become a rugby player playing for Ireland on the male team, but by encouraging them at that moment to dream, somewhere along the way they will refine the dream themselves, but they'll still have the confidence to pursue and to achieve something. So therefore, for me, the worst possible thing you could do is argue with a young person or say, "Well, that's not possible," or, "Well, you're not going to be able to do that," or whatever. And to be honest with you, I think that some people did that to me when I was young. I would say to people like, "Oh, I'd like to be a poet. What are you going to be when you grow up?" I'd say, "A poet." And they'd say, "But sure, you wouldn't be able to do it. Sure, you can't earn money in poetry." Now, as it turned out, I refined my dream as I went along, and I realised at 70 years of age I became a a writer, so I write books. So I'm writing memoirs. So I'm writing in the newspaper. So it's not exactly as clear and wonderful as I dreamed of when I was a teenager, saying, oh, I'm going to be a poet for the rest of my life. I refined my dream the same way somebody who might say they want to be a rugby player playing for Ireland, they might refine their dream as they go along, so long as you don't take their dream away. And you don't take their dream away because you don't argue with them. You know? And sometimes it can be, I personally would find it tricky sometimes. I'm listening to a young person, I'm not talking about my own family, but just in general, you might be listening to them on the radio or the television or just meeting them out in public. And they would say things and they would express dreams that would be so naive and so crazy and so silly and so lazy that you'd want to give them a slap. But I never do. I never criticise them. That's what they're dreaming of. And the important issue is not the content of the dream, but the fact that they're dreaming. And if you encourage them to dream, they will refine the details to suit themselves as they get older and into their 20s. They will see that, well, I can't reach the stars, but as the old proverb used to say, it's by aiming at the stars that you reach the top of the mountain. And that's why at the end of that little story, this reflection on David Marcus, who was literary editor of the Irish Press, who changed my life because he was positive and encouraged my poetry and he published the poems. And to be honest, looking back at it, some of the poems weren't great. And it amazes me that he had that utter confidence in young writers to just encourage them, and by publishing them, it was his real strong way of encouraging them. And I saw that table as the place where I used to dream. And I realized then that when my father, who had been poor, who had struggled to be an accountant, and who had said to me one time, when he was reading my poems, he said to me one time, I would have loved to have been a writer, but I couldn't. So playing with words wasn't possible for him, so he played with numbers and became an accountant. And he was happy and fulfilled in that. But there was still a kind of a failed writer in him, because you could see that when he was in his 50s and 60s, he started writing reviews, and he was sending them to the same editor, David Marcus, in the Irish Press. And he was writing them at that same dining table. And so that table was the table of my dreams, the table of my father's dreams. And because it accidentally remained in my home right through the childhood of my child, it became the table of her dreams as well. I love that sense that something was shared by those three generations. And the fact that that something has now been transformed into a shelf, a kind of a worktop in the shed, in the garden shed, it tells me everything about impermanence. That not only do our dreams change as we get older, but everything changes. Our bodies change, our faces change, the houses we live in change, the chairs we sit at change. Everywhere is full of our discarded properties. Our old computers, our old combs, our old electric heaters, our old fan heaters, our old manuscripts, our old diaries, our old glasses, pairs of glasses stuffed into drawers. It's as if Everything we touch, we use, and then it passes. Its time passes. And even if we can hand it on to one or two more generations, still the time will come that a leg will fall off the chair or the table, and it'll pass and be used as something else. And in all those times, dreams change. Dreams get modified. You know, even when some people, I've met people who dreamed of the perfect lover and didn't find the perfect lover, and found, and this is true, I remember 30 and 40 years ago talking to a couple of different people who had met somebody, and they would say, you know, he's not the man of my dreams, but he's a good man. And I see that couple 30 years later, and they're deeply in love. Even though on the day of their wedding there would have been a slight tinge of making do. He wasn't Cary Grant. He wasn't Sean Penn or Robert Redford or whoever. But he was a good man, she might have said. He will provide. He will be truthful. He has good character. And that's how our dreams, even in love, change. So that when we find a partner, when we marry or enter a relationship, there's a moment where, not perfect, but don't let the perfection ruin your chances of a very happy life in marriage. Because I have seen that journey in friends, and I'm thinking of one particular friend, a woman, and as I say, she knew at a certain point, this fella is, you know, he wasn't, what do you say, an oil painting. He wasn't an oil painting. A stout little man. Nothing romantic about him, really. But she says to me, he's a good man. And I know them 30 years later, and I know that they're so romantically in love. It's gorgeous to see it. The trick is, your dreams will refine themselves, your dreams will change. But always dream. So if I bring this sense of confidence in young people a little step further, last night, I was in a place called Killinumery, and it was a sort of a little conference, a little evening about mental health. And there were three beautiful speakers. The first speaker was, her name is Leah Cull, and she'd be a kind of a resilience speaker. She talks with people about the difficulties she had in her youth and childhood and how she overcame them. And what she talks about are mental health issues in her family that caused a suicide. And she talks to people now about how she overcomes that terrible event that happened in her childhood, in her youth. She talks about being resilient and being confident, and particularly about going for help. She said that, for example, trauma, because for her that was a trauma. So she says trauma, you can't solve it without talking. It's in the body physically, but you need to talk it out. The body keeps the score of the trauma. The trauma is in the body. You're not going to medicate your way out of it. That was another phrase she used. You're not going to get out of this with tablets. You're not going to get out of it with drink. You're only going to get out of it if you go and talk to somebody. And it can be in your life, she was saying, like for your whole life. You could be 60 or 70 years of age and still be carrying some trauma that happened in your childhood that you haven't shared, that you haven't spoken of. And you might have found a way to self-medicate and cope with it. It might have shaped the entire way you are as a person, but to go and seek help was her huge message. She had a trauma, and she also realised, because obviously she's talking about a close relative who committed suicide, so she's talking about somebody in her life that she loved and who is no longer alive. I mean, I think it's the thing that people who are drawn into suicide, it's like they're missing that single detail. What will life be like when you're dead? When you don't exist? So you're not healing anything by suicide. You're just obliterating yourself. Obliterating your opportunity of healing. So she had that close sense of having lost somebody to suicide, but also the trauma of it actually happening. You can imagine the trauma of a suicide for a young person. And so she was saying that she early on very quickly went into therapy, went into counselling, got help, and talked it out so completely and fully that she's ended up becoming qualified as somebody in psychotherapy who can help other people. And I thought that was it showed courage and strength and beauty and just so wonderful that, you know, when your dreams have been shattered as a young person, when your body is traumatized by your broken dreams, there is help. And she was very quick and frequent in the way that she'd mentioned certain phone numbers of, you know, resources there are in her locality. We're near Sligo, and you know, she was talking about various agencies within the health board and in voluntary organisations that are available to people. So I think that's really one hugely important thing to talk about. When the dreams are broken in young people, and when there's a danger that they become so fragile with their broken dreams that the trauma inside their bodies is internalized and they self-medicate and they don't talk to anybody. It's like, never underestimate the powerful support that is out there. From therapy, from agencies working with the health boards. So that was the first speaker, and she was very powerful. Well, the second speaker was another woman who teaches meditation and mindfulness. And again, she spoke about her trauma, which was, and she told the audience it was stressful for her. It took huge courage for her to talk about it, but she talked about the way she was sexually abused when she was 6 years of age. It's hard to think about. So she talked about this, but then she also talked about how powerful for her meditation became. How, you know, breathing exercises and awareness exercises and single-pointed meditation, that how powerful the healing was from going and finding that. And that was, again, a very emotional and powerful bearing witness to the fact that when your dreams are broken, imagine a six-year-old abused sexually, imagine the destruction of that child's dreams, and imagine the trauma in that child's body. And imagine then that there is a pathway out of that. Not that maybe ever fixes it fully, but that in some way allows a person to cope with, to deal with, and to heal. And it's called talk therapy. And again, to find somebody is easy. And then, particularly for this woman, she was talking about meditation. So there were two very powerful ways of talking about how our dreams can be broken and how, rather than leave them internalized in the body, find meditation, find talk therapy as pathways out of it. And in both those situations, it felt to me like, you know, I talk about meditation not as a therapist, but simply as a kind of a storyteller. I'm sharing my story, as my story of my life, and my story very much involves faith, very much involves where meditation slips over into faith. I can't live without faith. And the last person to speak last night at this meeting was a priest, Father John Joe Duffy. He's a priest up in Chrishla in Donegal. And he again talked about a trauma he had was when he was young, his father was drowned. He wasn't a child now, but he was young enough. And losing a person in violent circumstances, whether it be in a car crash or drowned at sea or something, is a terrible violence. And it is inflicted on the people who are left behind. And that too is a trauma that will go into the body. And the body will hold on to this trauma until it's talked out. And the one thing obviously that a priest might add, and he added it very, very well, was that above and beyond all the counselling, he found that for him, faith in God, in heaven, that his father was with God, that was a huge consolation. And that drew me to that whole sense that I have. You know, I've a deep feeling about religion being good for your sense of mental health. You know, that regardless of it being true or not, that asking about, well, is there a God or is there not a God, is like, that's a philosophical question. You could leave that to the philosophers. But in the meantime, the process of acting out rituals that express belief in a God or a Buddha or whatever, a mentor deity, the expression of this hope as ritual, as prayer, is actually good for your mental health. I find it's good for mine, that's all I'm saying. I went into such a deep depression in 2011, and it took me about a year and a half to even begin to come out of it. And I couldn't believe that I was in such a depression. I mean, I just could not believe. It's like, you know, if you fall into a bog hole and break your ankle, there's a part of you can't believe it. Why did I do this? Why did I fall in here? Why am I so stupid? Or why did it happen to me? That sense of shock goes with every trauma that happens to us. Why is this happening to me? Why am I being picked out for this misfortune? And I certainly felt that initially in 2011 and 2012 when I was suffering from depression. And it was like just so black. I mean, it was like I could feel a blackness behind everything I looked at. It was almost like a visual, like a strange sense of an invisible blackness behind everything. There was nothing. If somebody said, would you look out the window at the beautiful flowers? I would look out at the beautiful daffodils and it would depress me. I would see them as awful, as if there was some black rottenness behind them that I sensed was there inside the visual. And I think that at that stage, my depression, you know, was coming out of a huge medical trauma because I'd been in hospital with medical issues. But it was black. And I couldn't believe it. And it was so it went on for so long and became such a pattern, and I wasn't a young fella that could change his life. I was, you know, I was in my 60s, beginning my 60s, late 50s, beginning my 60s. You think, like, I'm never going to get out of this. And I used to say that to my beloved wife, and I used to say to people close to me, I used to honestly ask, am I going to get out of this? The way a child might ask if they were locked in a room. And people would look at me and say, yes, you will get out of it. My doctor would say it to me. I was so terrified one time in those years, and my anxiety levels would get so high that I remember I had a plane ticket for Warsaw. A plane would be leaving Dublin at 9 o'clock in the morning. You'd have to be in Dublin Airport at about 5 o'clock, and you'd leave here at about 2 o'clock from Leitrim. And I remember getting up to go, getting up to head off, bag packed from the night before. And at the very last minute, I had to phone and say, I can't make it to Warsaw. I can't get there. I'm not able to get in the car to drive to Dublin. It's too much. My anxieties were that intense. Anxiety about what? About nothing. So I was in such a black hole. I couldn't believe I fell into it. And then when I was in it, there was no way I could believe that I'll ever get out of it. I thought, this is like a new part of my life. Well, I want to share with you. I want to share with you this. I got out of that because of faith. In other words, my faith, reactivating my Buddhist practice and my Christian faith, allowed me a shape in the day. It allowed me rituals. It allowed me to play with icons and lights and going into churches and doing meditations and visiting my Buddhist center. It allowed me to imagine the world as a place of hope. And that structure in my imagination healed me. And today, I don't get up worrying, will I have another black day of depression? And I firmly believe that it is as a result of my prayer life. And I don't mean that that is some sort of proclamation that, you know, the truth lies in religion. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that faith can be a help towards wellness. And expressing faith by going into a church or by lighting a candle, you can do it even if you don't believe. You can embody it physically. Just do it. And you'll find that by the doing of it, by embodying faith, you then develop faith. And the more you embody it, the more you develop it. I always say this, you know, put an icon up in the corner. And I'm quoting a great friend who was a great friend now, you know, for a while. He was from Belarus. He was an icon maker. Met him in Warsaw. And he would say to me, Michael, if you bring an icon into the house, it will change you. You do it even if you don't believe. I always say it, put the icon up there in the corner and light a little nightlight in front of it for 20 minutes every day. Even just light the, and then walk around. You could be doing hoovering. You don't have to sit looking at it even. It's looking at you. You'll feel it beginning to look at you. At a poetic level, you're opening up to a presence that transcends your ego. A presence that is palpitating and pulsing in every in every molecule of the cosmos. You are the cosmos in this moment. You're not confined by the parameters of your own ego. And this lighting of a candle in front of an icon or in front of a Buddha or whatever way you want to do this, it opens that door, it unlocks that door into the deeper layer of who you are. So you do it physically, because we are embodied creatures. You can actually do it physically without necessarily believing it. It's like being an actor. It's like saying, well, I don't think that lighting a candle in front of an icon is make one bit of a difference to my life today, but I'm going to do it anyway to see what happens. Or I do not believe that walking into a church as I pass it and sitting or kneeling there for 3 minutes and saying some sort of rigmarole of a prayer, I don't believe that's going to make any difference in my life. Okay, but do it. Just do it as a ritual, as like a kind of a mysterious ritual. So you're embodying something. Remember again that what I was saying earlier, our bodies hold trauma. And we don't like believe in trauma. We don't remember trauma. Sometimes we forget it completely, and yet it's in our body. Somewhere in our body is holding the memory of a trauma. So there's some way whereby the body can hold on to aspects of who you are that you're not conscious of. And if that's true in a negative way, it may be also true in a positive way. That by doing something in an embodied way, physically, like the candle, like visiting the church, by doing it physically, embodying the prayer, if you like, you may be unlocking something that you're not conscious of. You may be unlocking a deeper sense of your own beauty, your own wonderful, calm, abiding self that you're not aware of. And you don't need to be aware of it before you do it, but if you do it, gradually you'll become aware of your deeper self. And that's what, you know, Yuri meant when he said to me, bring an icon into the house and it will change you. It will change you. It's not that you're saying, I will change myself now that I have an icon in the house. No, the icon will change you. It is the key. This has been a different podcast. It's been very personal because I came out of last night with a deep sense of how young people have such courage when they express a trauma that has affected them, and when they talk about abuse, or when they talk about how going into therapy has helped them positively in life. And that made me reflect on how important it was to encourage young people and to be tender with them and to encourage their dreams, even if their dreams seem a little bit off the wall to us as older people. Encourage them. It's the one most precious thing to do. And they will find how to refine the dream. And if the speakers last night then who were talking about how their dreams were destroyed, how their dreams were broken, and how they used therapy to heal themselves, I couldn't avoid listening to that powerful priest who spoke about how simply faith had been a particularly helpful consolation for him. And I was thinking, well, that's true in my life too, because that's exactly what happened to me when I fell into depression. And I came to do this morning, and to be honest with you, I couldn't resist sharing the immediacy of this with you. The immediacy of one single song of joy. Mullen Oiga, praise the young people, and they will flourish. I hope you flourish for the weekend, and thank you for being here. Bye-bye.